Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome to the Neil Garfield Show, a presentation sponsored by www.livinglies.wordpress.com, GTC Honored, and The Garfield Firm, serving all 50 states with news and analysis of the latest bank scams against borrowers, homeowners, consumers, and investors, and providing legal representation throughout Florida. This program is for general information only. It is not a solicitation for services or legal representation and should never be used as a substitute for advice from a licensed professional. And now, here's world-renowned financial expert, attorney, and blogger, Neil Garfield.
Hello. Today is January 4th, 2018. Welcome, everyone, to our new year. This is Attorney Charles Marshall. I am broadcasting live from Southern California, and this is the West Coast Foreclosure Show. And I will have Bill Padillo again joining me to discuss some matters related in and out of bankruptcy practice. In other words, some matters will relate to bankruptcy practice and some will relate to civil cases outside of bankruptcy. And as always, I am broadcasting every other week on this Thursday show. And then on alternating Thursdays, Neil will be broadcasting his show. This show is brought to you by GTC Honors, Living Lies, and LendingLies.com. And it is made possible because of the generous donations from listeners like you. Thank you. Any amount you're able to donate is appreciated, and you can donate directly by selecting the donate button on the blog at www.livinglies.wordpress.com. Now, today, Bill and I are going to be addressing agency and chain of assignment issues, as we so often do. And there's one particular area that we have brought scrutiny to before, which we will do as well today. And that relates to how certain endorsements that are made in assignment documents, be that a substitution of trustee, sometimes another assignment of a legal interest related to a purported originating loan, where these documents are supposed to have declarations associated with them, in which the declarant is averring that they're making specific detailed reference to the document, and then they have specialized and specific knowledge. And as is so often the case, this knowledge just isn't there. And Bill, you had some particular ones that you were recently dealing with that certainly bear telling the listeners about. Why don't you go into that at this time?
Sure. Well, first of all, happy New Year, Charles, and to all the listeners out there. Thanks for tuning in, and 2018 is going to be a good year for all, I hope. I wanted to make a point today, and it's a very simple point, because after all this time in this business, I still get calls frequently from pro se litigants and attorneys around the country who are still struggling with the defenses against these note endorsements that come in with at the last minute with these ta-da endorsements and allonges that we now know, based on so much information in the public domain and admissions and everything else, that these endorsements again are being slapped on at the last minute on these images that are in their computer platforms. and they're doing that for, you know, purposes of proceeding with the litigation. And what I'm really getting frustrated with, because I have to keep pounding on the table and pounding my fist and telling people that are prosecuting these cases, is that you have to compel these servicer system screenshots. You have to go after the note history, note custody screens that are in the custody and control of every one of these servicers' platforms and their servicing systems. So I'm providing, again, an example in the Didrick case, which was a Florida case that I was involved in South Florida. That's a typical screenshot right there that gives you information that, one, the note was likely destroyed, because the witness in that case, when questioned about that, was testifying that that the original note was in her possession, standing right there on the witness stand, but yet she couldn't answer the question as to whether or not that screenshot said it was destroyed. And she also couldn't answer the question about the note endorsement being applied a month before the onstart of the litigation there. So we know that courts are getting more leery of these witnesses coming in, claiming that they have knowledge of prior servicers' records and the boarding processes and so on and so forth. And so I wanted to also show you this latest declaration by a gentleman by the name of Scott Aronowitz, if that's how you pronounce it, in Washington State in a case I'm working on, who claims to be a litigation specialist for Celine Finance. And this declaration, if you look at paragraph 2, is, I mean, there's no way to put it. I mean, it's laughable. Here you have a guy who my preliminary research shows is in-house counsel of some sort. Can't confirm. He is an attorney, but I can't confirm if he actually works for Celine or not. But in his paragraph there, he says that he familiarized himself with the records of practices, record-keeping practices of Countrywide and Recon Trust and Wilmington Savings, who's the plaintiff in the case. I mean, it's almost laughable that he has any personal knowledge of that. But one thing that sticks out to me in his written testimony is that if he is claiming that prior to him executing this document, he went in and reviewed Recon Trust's records, Wilmington's records, Celine's records, that these parties are using a global system of some sort where they can go in and access records from all the different parties and various parties out there. I mean, and that's very telling, and that's probably a topic we can discuss later on. But so I kind of want to pants this Aronowitz guy a little bit here today, because we have, and I'm seeing this more frequently, these declarations that are being provided, turns out that these are really in-house attorneys that are executing these things, and they're claiming they have personal knowledge. Now, why that's happening, I'm still kind of delving into possible theories as to why they're kind of concealing the fact that they're licensed attorneys. There could be a possibility that they're trying to get around various jurisdictions' requirements that the courts may have, that they have to announce themselves and possibly pay fees for limited appearances in cases. That could be a possibility. Could also be a possibility that this plays into attorney-client privilege, where if they leave that position or leave that job, they're held to a higher standard to not disclose what it is that they were doing or the information that they had privy to on these system platforms. But anyway, getting back to my original point, Charles, I just want to hammer on this, is that we know that these loan history screenshots exist, and you have to force the other side immediately in discovery to cough those documents up, because they no longer, based on all the evidence that certainly I can put forward, have the they should be getting the presumption that these documents and these endorsements are valid. And so with all the evidence as you stack it up, if they refuse to cough it up, which they do universally, the next step obviously is to compel it. You've got to go after that document because that will basically tell you in that servicing screenshot exactly when that endorsement was placed and whether or not oftentimes if that note was destroyed. So it's very important to prosecute these cases and to go after this information specifically right up front.
So is one way of looking at this to say, in a kind of show-me-the-note scenario, if you've got the documented servicing issue, which parenthetically I'll tell the listeners, again, however much we talk about the importance of discovery, here it is again. This is where discovery would typically be needed to get to this level of detail. But to follow up that point, with the show me the note scenario, where the production of the note, from an evidentiary point of view, you're at a stage in the case, let's say even a trial, where it's critical that they actually bring this into the trial proceeding. It sounds like what you're saying is, you know, in this scenario, the declarant's claiming to have three different institutional hats on, and meanwhile he's an attorney when typically the individual making these declarations would be some sort of corporate executive. I mean, is that part of what's going on here?
Well, yeah, but well, first let me say that, you know, this isn't a show me the note defense. I mean, clearly, you know, that is going to fail every single time if it's basically saying you don't have the original note. It's not so much, you know, they're attesting that they're holding the original note, number one. And it's very difficult to challenge the authenticity without having, you know, experts come in, document examiners that are qualified with computer-generated forgery, counterfeits. I mean, it's a very expensive proposition to take on to try to contest the authenticity of that. What I'm saying is that the endorsement that is placed on the note, whether the note itself is original or not, the party that placed that on there was not oftentimes, we don't know. I mean, they have nobody that has any information as to when it was put on, who put it on, or anything. I mean, they have no witness that can speak to the custody of it, to any of it. But we do know that the evidence shows that they are being slapped on by somebody who is not the person whose name is appearing on it. And it's oftentimes, like in the Arkansas case, they're slapping an officer of a corporation that either the corporation's been long gone, dead, defunct, bankrupt, out of business, whatever it might be. I mean, they're counterfeiting the endorsement. And that's where you want to go in, and when you want to get into all the UCC issues or whatever, I mean, you're going to say, listen, somebody marked that, and they didn't have the present intent to do that, or they didn't have the authorization. One of the areas that I also say, when you're going into the discoveries, show me the corporate resolution where these parties were given the authority to execute these documents as officers of the companies. For example, the Cynthia Riley notorious robo stamp that we see on the Washington Mutual notes. I mean, when J.P. Morgan Chase has been pressed, and there's a case in Florida in the Wisem case to cough up the corporate resolution where they authorized her in that capacity or anybody, surrogates in her name to sign, where's the corporate resolution authorizing that them to do that? They say, we don't have anything like that or in our possession. We can't find it. I mean, see, none of this exists. So, but if you want a smoking gun, that's what you're going to get in those servicing screenshots, because that typically those servicing screenshots shouldn't be tampered with and cannot be erased. And if they have it in their possession, they're going to get real nervous having to supply that, and they're going to try to redact it, and they're going to try to play games all day long if they're forced to have to cough it up. But right now, there's not enough pressure out there. Nobody, even to this day, I find it amazing, and that's that there's not enough pressure being put on the opposition and the courts to compel these screenshots. That, you know, because now, you know, it's like basically saying that's where the body's buried, Your Honor, and I can show it and I can prove it, and here's all the, you know, so just cough it up. It's really not that difficult to push that.
I think that makes a lot of sense, and I think you're also onto something with the attorney angle as a declarant in these cases. I mean, for the business records exception to the hearsay rule to apply, which of course is why these types of documents are allowed into evidence to begin with, in order for the business records exception to apply, it should be somebody who, during the course of their regular day activity, their regular employee activity, is signing these types of documents. And if they're bringing in an attorney who's just handling a bunch of other corporate matters, possibly not even doing that, possibly brought in under kind of some kind of special aegis, where they don't have any kind of prehistory of dealing with similar documents, you know, half less having their review as the daily part of what they do, that really raises all kinds of issues, even potential red flags, about the attorney authority, of course, as a declarant. Do they really meet the business records exception, number one? But number two, potential due diligence issues, because in fiduciary issues, because attorneys are held to a higher standard, and whether you're signing, you know, a document in your state of record, so to speak, where you have an attorney license or you're signing it somewhere else, you're still held to a fiduciary standard, and you're held to be somebody, whenever you sign documents of any kind, to have personal knowledge and so that you can attest to the authenticity of what you're signing. So, you know, I think that is a big issue.
Yeah, we, you know, and again, we don't know what the role is of that attorney. And I would also recommend, when you start seeing these declarations, you have to ask the question. If you get a chance anyway in a deposition or on the stand, if that witness appears, are you an attorney? You know, because unless you ask or put that forward in some sort of a discovery request or question or interrogatory, I mean, they're just going to continue to conceal that information for some reason. But I think it's very important if the court knows that that's an attorney who's actually putting their name on this garbage. Yes, I think they should be held to a higher standard. At least you think the system would hold them to a higher standard.
Right. And again, it's legally relevant to some extent whether they are licensed in the district, in the state, in the jurisdiction under which the document is being signed. But even if they're licensed elsewhere, they're still held to a higher standard, and I think that is something that we can work, so to speak. Shifting gears a little bit on this whole question of bankruptcy procedure and civil procedure, one of the issues I've seen come up over the years, and I would like to think that it's gone away, but it hasn't, is in non-judicial foreclosure states and cases, you know, especially prevalent here on the West Coast. What I've seen repeatedly in California is that when a plaintiff's lawsuit is brought forward, if there's a previous bankruptcy history of the plaintiff, what often will happen is one of the defendant's legal firms handling their defense, they'll come forward in their inevitable demurrer, and one of their opposition claims is going to be, well, this lawsuit is subject to judicial estoppel, and this plaintiff should be stopped from proceeding at all in their case because they didn't list this lawsuit as a claim on their schedules. So what that means is what you have to do proactively in California and these non-judicial states where you could be bringing a plaintiff's lawsuit potentially is if you're in a bankruptcy proceeding, you want to list on Schedule B your possible lawsuit so that when you do file a lawsuit later after the bankruptcy is dismissed or discharged, then it will essentially take away that argument because you will see that. It's not like it's invariable. Some defense law firms will use it, some won't. And I would think that this is something that would have gone away in the last year or two, and I have seen less of it. Used to see it a lot 2 or 3 years ago. I'm appalled. I can't say that I'm shocked, but I am appalled that this is still something plaintiffs litigants have to deal with in these cases. Because one of the critical elements of the judicial estoppel argument is that there's an implication of fraud on the part of the debtor, the borrower, in quotes. I mean, and this becomes an issue even if the bankruptcy was let's say gone through 4 years ago. So let's say I've seen this problem 7 years. Let's say you have a litigant who's suing now, and he or she had a bankruptcy that was discharged 7 or 8 years ago. If they didn't list this claim that they're suing on now, way back then, 7 or 8 years ago, I mean, lots of homeowners, lots of others who sued to protect a property interest, they didn't know they had a claim 7 or 8 years ago. They hadn't discovered Neil's show at that time, or they hadn't done a loan audit. They hadn't coordinated with anybody who told them about the kinds of fraud that goes on that we try to expose on this show. And so in the real world, of course they didn't list it on their bankruptcy schedules. And even if they did know that they might have a claim, listing this kind of lawsuit on a bankruptcy schedule is not like listing a slip and fall where you have multiple breaks in your leg and there's clear liability on the part of the store that you fell in front of. I mean, these lawsuits have tons of moving parts and contingencies. I think it's too strong a word to say that they're speculative, but they are not based on ironclad law. These cases are able to move forward because there's sufficient law to justify their moving forward, but they're not a slam dunk. And I think everybody who looks at this legal area has a similar assessment as far as that goes. Nevertheless, the claims are still brought in good faith, and particularly on the Homeowner Bill of Rights, these cases will often go forward. So in the real world, what all that means is if you're suing currently and you have a bankruptcy in your history, it may become a problem if you didn't list the lawsuit you're bringing on Schedule B. Now, you could reopen the bankruptcy, and if you were in a Chapter 13, that's not too big a deal. It's always inconvenient to reopen a bankruptcy. There's certain legal risk when you reopen a bankruptcy, but generally speaking, with a Chapter 13, if that's the chapter that you were in when you could have listed this lawsuit and didn't. And again, the idea that you're not listing it means that you committed a fraud. I mean, that's the legal predicate for the judicial estoppel applying. And judges find it all the time, even when there's no proven allegation that the reason it wasn't listed was because of fraud. But what I'm trying to say is Chapter 13, you might want to reopen it. Chapter 7, there are going to be legal issues about it reopening in Chapter 7, and you could be tied up in court a long time. So it's kind of beyond the scope of this show to go into all those now. But you won't necessarily be able to dismiss a Chapter 7 once you reopen it. There are a number of variables to consider. I mean, what's your experience of this situation, Bill?
Well, to be honest, I mean, it's a good thing you're bringing this up. I think you make a really great point. I haven't been hearing much of that from clients that I'm, you know, from other states that I have where this is being challenged after the fact, but you make a great point. I mean, half of these issues that we have or claims that are arising due to fraud and things that are, you know, it's slow to come out and be unearthed. And, yeah, why should the homeowners be held to that standard or whatever if they had no idea that these claims even existed, really? So it's very interesting. I want to look into that a little bit more. But that's a really excellent point, Charles.
Right. I mean, and again, the truly appalling aspect to this is that fraud is one of the elements to be proven out for the judicial estoppel to apply. And way too often, judges are just finessing the whole fraud issue. In other words, they're simply treating the failure to list the lawsuit previously on bankruptcy schedules as fraudulent. And I've never seen a showing in all the years I've been handling, you know, these cases. And again, right, I mean, this is not something that comes up in every case. And sometimes I won't see it in many cases in a row, but I just recently encountered it on a case that was filed somewhat recently. So that's a situation where it's shocking, frankly, that the bankruptcy at issue was 6 years ago. So it's so remote in time to what's going on now that the facts at issue were completely different then. In fact, the theoretical framework for the contested case now, yes, the assignment predicates existed then, but the borrower wasn't even behind in payments of any kind, you know, ostensible or otherwise. So the idea that he would have listed this lawsuit on his bankruptcy schedules is laughable. And yet it prevented a preliminary injunction from going forward recently. Just that argument. So it does have real world consequence. And on our side, when litigants, whether they have an attorney or they're going pro se, it's important for them to address the fraud element and show and adhere in their pleadings that there's been no showing from the other side that they committed fraud in their bankruptcy, that they had some kind of fraudulent intent to conceal. And there isn't even a case law out there that has any kind of, let's put it this way, I haven't seen any case law that goes convincingly to the legal issue of whether the failure to list the lawsuit, that the failure to list it, just that failure by itself has some kind of fraudulent implication. There seriously isn't any serious case law. I haven't seen any significant case law at all. And I haven't even seen any case law cited to that element. And yet judges seem all too willing to literally put that element into their findings when they find judicial estoppel applies. Well, I appreciate you being on our show today, Bill.
Well, my pleasure as always. Thanks.
Yes, thank you. And again, Neil will be back next Thursday. I'll be here alternating Thursdays. And Godspeed to all of our listeners in the meantime.
Thanks for listening to our broadcast. We hope that you tell your friends about us and let them know that there is hope and help in this financial crisis. Tune in every week to The Neil Garfield Show for free information and advice, and visit our blog daily at The Living Lies Blog. We provide support services, the latest strategies,